This is Care and Compliance in the Real World, a podcast from CAC, part of the Baldwin Group. Hosted by Peter Winterburn and Erica Holman, this podcast brings together decades of experience in senior living, healthcare, risk management, and compliance. Drawing on backgrounds in law, insurance, operations, and senior care leadership, they sit down with industry experts to explore the real-world challenges organizations face every day. Each episode delivers practical conversations and actionable insights to help you navigate risk, strengthen compliance, and better care for the people you serve. Let's get started.
I think this is a good topic, even though allegedly 3,000 jobs were added to the skilled nursing workforce. I think 3,000 is not enough because of claims.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Just in high-performing locations, looking at how we're hiring, who's doing it, how does it create risk? How does it stabilize a risk culture? You speak to it with your lawyerly lens, and I can speak to it from why is it important to operationalize it? What does it mean for your retention and your budget?
We can talk about that in the context of regulatory and legal. I think staffing is still the number one argument in the playbook of the plaintiff's lawyers.
You just said something interesting. You just said the magic words, which came up when I was reading, which is, it's an operational problem. That's how we look at it as defense and an operator, whereas plaintiff attorneys and surveyors, families look at it as a systems failure.
It remains the number one argument in their playbook. Staffing is the hook that the plaintiff's lawyers use to tell the story, the profits over people model in a particular case that, you know, that the corporate fat cats didn't care about the residents, care about their bottom line, and staffing is the way that they intend to prove that or make that argument to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And so staffing remains a linchpin of the argument that if a bad event occurred or if poor care happened, then it's because of staffing deficiencies. And even if the two have nothing to do with each other in a given case, and even if they have really no causation in a case for what caused the injury, it's a really sexy argument to make that if Mrs. Smith fell and died and you were understaffed, then any jury, any member of the public draws that line in their mind, regardless of if it's true or not. I would have cases where the facility was, quote, understaffed, let's say 4 days of the week. On the fifth day of the week, they were overstaffed above the state minimum or the PPD or whatever was the regulation minimum for that time in that location. They were overstaffed, and that's when the fall occurred. Well, I would try to get the judge to throw out the argument that understaffing caused this because there's no causation to that fall, right? But the judge and the jury and everybody and the plaintiff's lawyer wants to say, no, the facility was chronically understaffed, and they want to tell the story that understaffing is what causes these injuries when it's really not. There are times that you can draw a line from understaffing to an injury, perhaps, but it's very tenuous.
Let me ask you a question. If facilities looked at other metrics besides their workforce numbers, their staffing ratios, what if they pulled in things like routinely looking at call light response times, fall rates? How accurate is documentation? Do you think they could paint a good picture of their true risk exposure by using other metrics in alignment with staffing? So, hey, even though we were staffed at a 3.0 and state requirements are 3 to 5, we hit all these metrics and we were successful in all these areas. Do you think that approach would be a good perspective for an operator to consider?
Absolutely. But yes, and anything you can do to tell the story that the care was good and conscientious and there were caring people at the helm, that there were caring people taking care of these residents, and it can be manifested, it can be shown by these different things. That's a great way to make your community defensible. I'm talking about it from the legal standpoint. I think things in terms of defensibility, of course, it's a great way to provide good care is what we really care about. But when you get sued, you want to be defensible. And a way to do that, even if you might be slightly understaffed, if you're doing all these other four things well, then yes, absolutely, you should tell that story and you should focus on those things. I will say it's a little bit like trying to play from behind the eight ball, though, if you're at all. That is going to be the thing the plaintiff's lawyers and the jury hear and care about and seize on is, okay, yeah, they were doing all these other good things, but why weren't they staffed to the state minimum? It's sort of like maybe you can explain why on a given day you weren't. There was a call in, or there was a no show, or there was a reason that was reasonable why we were understaffed that day. But you've got to be really careful and try to tell that story early and often in a lawsuit, in a claim. And it usually falls on deaf ears unless you have a really compelling reason why you are under that statement.
Often more events happen when the staffing is richer. And that's probably anecdotal. It seems sometimes when there's more staff than you would ever know what to do with, more events occur. Bystander effect, like, oh, I don't need to get it because we're at a 5.0. I've seen buildings that run as high as 6.2, which is unheard of, and they have a high rate of falls and falls with injury. I think it kind of is, oh, somebody else has the eyes on the person, or we're not checking in on them because we're doing activities with a group of people because we have more time. That would be a really interesting area for a compliance or a quality assurance study for some of our providers, something where it wouldn't necessarily be discoverable, but they could start gathering some data and look at clusters of data to see if there's a relationship. I do have to say, too, I think another thing people have an opportunity to do, and this might be out of the realm of legal strategy. Labor studies are important because you know how long it takes your staff to get an oxygen tank, to go find supplies. Labor studies are another piece of really doing a good job deploying the workforce that you have. Mm-hmm. And I don't see people talking about those things. How much do you think that kind of information would ever play into defense, in the sense that, hey, we've done these labor studies and we have everything accessible. We have X, Y, and Z right here for the staff. I mean, do you think anything like that would ever help or not?
It could. And the way that I see that coming into the defensibility of a case would be through an expert witness.
Okay.
So whether that's, and whether that's the DON of the facility or a medical person in the case that could be deemed a medical expert, usually it's through an expert that you've hired to defend a claim, and you could bring that type of research, those studies, that type of data into testimony in a case, to where you could have the expert in the deposition and on the witness stand at trial saying just what you're talking about. Here's a study that, and in my opinion, more likely than not, based on these, you know, researched journals and studies, my opinion is that having more staff to this number would not have made a difference. And here's why. Yeah. It can be based on the study. It can be based on the information. So that can be a really good thing. Of course, as we know, having been in the industry for so long, we often talk about the idea that the falls example, you know, falls are not always preventable, even if you have one-on-one care. Let's say you had 24/7 one-on-one care with every resident. Even in that instance, falls are not preventable. And yet, if a fall occurs with an injury, you could have a plaintiff's attorney that argues, well, they should have had more. If they had more people, it would have prevented a fall. It seems like a logical jump to make. However, it's not true. And that story has to be told in a way that combats our brain's notion that more people means more safety. And that's not always true.
That's a really good point. And I'm going to digress. I want to ask your opinion or pick your brain about the hiring process. I want to go back to that piece for just a moment. From a defensibility perspective, how critical do you think hiring and onboarding is?
Massively critical. hiring and onboarding can be.
Yeah, we never really hear about that, do we? Or do you? Do we hear about that a lot when you're defending clients?
We do. And we have talked about it for years. And a lot of times where it comes into play is in our defensibility series, we talk about culture, facility culture, building culture, company culture. A lot of that has to do with hiring. I mean, if you hire the right people, it can go really well. If you hire the wrong people that are not a culture fit, that will have a drag on the entire system, will have a drag on the leadership of the building, of the facility, of the community. So hiring and vetting is massively important. Unfortunately, in this industry, a lot of times we don't have great options, do we? Or we feel like we have a large enough pool to draw from that we feel like we can find really good talent, but it is out there and we have to continue to, redouble those efforts to be diligent.
I even propose that we peel back the onion one more layer, which is who's doing the interviewing and how well are they interviewing? There's a lot of evidence about motivational interviewing, making sure that instead of posting for a position, that you mm-hmm. look for characteristics. I think we've talked about this when we talk about defensibility and culture. We can't train someone to be thoughtful and considerate. We can train them to a task. And so I'm fascinated by that. I'm really interested in how well we hire, how well we train the people interviewing.
Yeah.
I think that piece is really mission critical.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
The other piece of that is training to competency.
Mm-hmm.
And I find
What do you mean by that? Why don't you define that a little bit for us?
Competency really means that you're adequate, right? You're able to do what the requirement of any job, duty, task, whatever, you can meet it. So competence in and of itself, it's good. It's probably good enough. When I think of competency training, I think of having people come back, do return demonstrations, having a process where you might have leadership within your nursing assistants where they might sign off on duties they can observe, and then they hand it over to a nurse leader for further review. Having hands-on training to show not just that you can do the minimum, but gosh, you might even be able to step above one or two steps. I think it's really important to look at competence from competence is just means you're hitting the bar. And I think people have an opportunity. It doesn't cost that much more money, and it improves retention when people feel like they're doing something meaningful.
Yeah, great point.
What do you think when you think about competency?
Yeah, and I agree with all of that. And you having been an operator for as long as you have, and I think you see that more day to day and kind of in the trenches, if you will. I see it more from the standpoint of after an event has happened. My rep role and task I felt like was to try to go and identify who were the competent people at the facility that we are witnesses. Who are the people that are competent, that are going to be good witnesses, and if there was a key person, a key witness in a case that I go and interview after the fact of an event and realize this person is not competent or would not do a good job or really doesn't seem to care a whole lot, or if there is a person like that, then that becomes a difficult case to defend. And so sometimes even going so far as to the point of thinking, okay, this isn't a good set of facts for us, and we don't have a good witness who we feel like is a good job here or is going to be a good witness. If they were competent at their job, do they come across as a caring person, is a big question.
I think that kind of difference too, because I do tend to get more down in the trenches. And it's always great to be brought up and, okay, what's our big attack plan to help people be more defensible? How do we support operators to be more defensible? And when we look at the staffing, it's really complex. I mean, sometimes you can have three staff and wow, they are rocking it. It is fantastic. And then the next day you might have five, but they're not, maybe they're not as tenured. Maybe they're not as interested, and it's chaotic. And so it's not the sheer number. How do we convey that? How do we kind of get that message out that it's that culture is really important? And I hate the word culture. I feel like it's really contrived.
How would you like to reframe it then? How do you think we should be talking about culture? Is kind of this catch-all word that gets overused. But how would you like to think of that idea when you are operating buildings or when you're talking to nurses now or folks now? What do you like to say?
I try not to say culture, that's for sure. I don't have better language. That's something I'll have to run through an AI program to find language. Just because I do think a lot of operators are jaded and they find the culture language artificial. And a lot of that, I think, goes back 20 and 30 years to the implementation of the Eden alternative and those kind of living situations, which are fantastic. But that language didn't feel natural to a lot of operators. And see, I might be outdated and not liking the word culture, and that would be a whole nother topic for us.
Yeah, that could be another topic of discussion. I think the basic idea seems to be the leaders of a community are really the culture setters. Ultimately, it's the company leaders, but when you get down to the level of having either regional directors or community directors, the EDs, right, the administrators, and then the DONs and the folks that are leading those communities, how are they showing up day to day? How are they walking into that building, and what type of, not culture, but what type of vibe?
Attitude. Yes, vibe. Yeah. Now, vibe was what I wanted to say. So you're picking up what I'm putting down. Yeah, the vibe, the attitude. You're exactly right about that. Sometimes people don't address their own feelings of maybe feeling defeated or burned out or tired. And so then instead of kind of giving themselves a little grace and taking an afternoon off, they feel like they work harder and do more, it's going to get better. And I think when we look at staffing, that attitude from the top down, not to say that a leader should be taking off a lot of time, but really should be setting an example. How do you recharge so that when you come back, your cup is full to take care of these residents?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Care and Compliance in the Real World, a podcast from CAC, part of the Baldwin Group. If you'd like to learn more about today's topic or how our healthcare specialists can help your organization navigate risk and compliance, we'd love to hear from you. Visit cacgroup.com or connect with your CAC advisor. Until next time, thanks for listening.